Welcome to Hidden Gems Toronto, the podcast that introduces you to a variety of fascinating people and places that fly under the radar but are a vital part of our city's fabric. I'm your host, urban geographer Tom Scanlon, and I invite you to don your virtual hiking boots and join us as we track down these compelling stories. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Season 2 of the Hidden Gems Toronto podcast. We've had a terrific summer off, and we are now pumped and ready to bring you a new podcast on the first day of every month. We kick off Season 2 with an episode entitled Partners in Crime. When I was growing up, I watched a lot of TV shows where a dog played the role of the hero. We had Lassie and the Littlest Hobo and, of course, Rin Tin Tin. In all these shows, the canines were always saving lives or catching thieves, finding lost people. When I got older, I came to realize there was a lot of trick photography in these shows. In fact, there wasn't just one Lassie, there was about a dozen of them. So I naturally believed that real dogs can never be as smart as the ones on TV. And if you share that view, well, after hearing today's podcast, you may change your mind. You are about to meet Sergeant Derek Gaudette, whose police dog Major is unlike any canine you have watched on television. In a recent article in the Toronto Star, columnist Wendy Gillis referred to Major as the Wayne Gretzky of sniffing, for it was Major who discovered the remains of the slain bodies hidden by serial killer Bruce MacArthur. He had placed them in planters in the backyard of a midtown Toronto home. Sergeant Gaudette gives a riveting account of how the discovery unfolded. We also interview retired RCMP officer Stacy Talbot. She has started a foundation to help cover the extensive veterinary bills that officers like Sergeant Gaudette, who adopt their retired police dogs, are faced with due to the physical demands on their dogs' bodies during their career. These are two very articulate, passionate people, and I think you will learn a lot from what they have to say. Hello, Derek, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
I guess besides thanking you, I should also thank Major. I hope I'm not intruding on your walking time today.
Yes, we got back about an hour ago, and he's having a relaxing time right now. It's pretty hot out there, so he's enjoying his air conditioning in the house right now.
Wonderful. You know, I've listened to you on other interviews, and I've noticed that you never refer to the Major as your dog. It's always your partner, and I guess that says a lot about your relationship.
Yes, it's a relationship that we build. It takes time, obviously, but I mean, I didn't go and buy him at a pet store. He was actually basically told by the trainers, say, this is the dog you're going to work with. And then I take the dog and start working with him from the beginning. So it wasn't like I picked him, but the trainers kind of picked us together. They see how I am as a handler and how that dog is reacting to certain things. And then they put us together. So I have to give kudos to my trainers who put us together.
I would think that you would try to match a dog that has a similar personality as the police officer, but that's not always the case, is it?
No, it's not always the case. What we try to do as canine handlers is try to get dogs. Let's say we have a very excitable dog and he takes a lot of strength, a lot of discipline to try to keep control of him. You wouldn't want an officer who has that in him as well, who's very abrupt and very strong, because then you're going to have two alphas butting heads all the time. So they kind of like give us a dog that has a bit of a temperament or some sort of strengths in it. Sure. They try to look at the officer and say, okay, this officer, and maybe a little bit more calmer. Maybe he sees that he can control this dog because he has a better mannerism to deal with that dog. And that's kind of how they put us together.
So just without going into all the detail, what kind of training did you have to go through for you to be in the canine unit? And then we can talk a bit about what Major went through.
Sure. I mean, we take officers at the canine unit who obviously have been on the road for a specific amount of time. Now, you have to go through your usual, work in the police vehicles and then maybe get into a squad or a unit of some sort, an investigative unit. We have to have officers that are good, well-rounded. That's basically how we look at it. And the second most important thing to that is physical strength and mental strength. So you have to go through a pretty hard physical test to get into the canine unit. The canine unit physical is probably the hardest one to pass because it's a very physical unit. You have a dog that's 100 pounds or 80 pounds or whatever. You're responsible for that dog to go wherever that dog's going. You have to lift them, carry them, throw them over fences, those kind of things. It's a very demanding physical job. So those two things have to go together.
Okay.
So that's how we kind of weed out officers who want to join the canine office.
And let's talk about Major. What kind of steps did he have to take to make it into the unit?
Well, it works with our dogs that we get. We get them from all over. They're in Canada and the U.S. And a lot of the dogs come from Europe, for example. So Major did come from Europe. He came from Holland. And he was flown into a broker in Pennsylvania. So our trainers go to Pennsylvania when they hear that they have dogs that are for sale, that are maybe good for police work. They go down, they'll evaluate, let's say, 10 or 20 dogs in a couple of days, start doing different things to see what kind of ball drive they have, just to see the way that they're skittish and those kind of things, and say, okay, now we're going to say maybe we're going to take 6 of those dogs out of the 20. And then at our unit, they start another week or so of just trying to see how the dog reacts to certain situations, see if they'll start smelling things, how their ball drive is, and so they go from there. And then we say, okay, maybe these 2 dogs out of the 6, we'll start training. So it's a pretty big process. It's not just every dog that can make it as a police dog.
Well, many are called, few are chosen.
Exactly, yeah.
It's my understanding that German Shepherds tend to be the best dogs for this sort of work?
Well, okay, maybe we use the word best, but they are the preferred dog, basically because of their size. You got a 250-pound suspect that you're chasing. You can't have a 40-pound or a 30-pound dog trying to take that person down, for example. The other thing is Shepherds, they're known for their bite. They have a very strong jaws, you know, they're very strong bite. So, I mean, that obviously helps in our job when a dog needs to apprehend somebody. Plus, they're very smart animals. Major, for an example, he's half and half. So he's half German Shepherd, half Belgian Malinois. And over in the Holland, they decided to make these 2 dogs together because now you have a Belgian Malinois, which is a little bit smaller than a German Shepherd. They can be anywhere, you know, 50, 60, 70 pounds. And the German Shepherd, and put them together and have this dog that has a crazy sense of drive, because a Belgian Malinois is just go, 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 go. And the smarts and the strength of a Shepherd. If you saw pictures of Major, you would see that he's not a full Shepherd because the hips aren't as low as a Shepherd. His head's a little bit smaller. That's how they came up with this combination of dog.
You know, of all the skills Major has, the one that really knocks my socks off is his ability to uncover cadavers in well-hidden spots. How do you even train for that? You don't have real cadavers to work with, do you?
No, we don't. Here in Ontario, and specifically most provinces in Canada, police officers are not allowed to have any type of human remains. So how we started off the dogs here in Toronto is that we use a specific source material from persons that were injured, for example. So if we have some bodily fluids from an ambulance services, blood, those kind of things, that's how we start getting the dog on that scent. And then how it worked out for when I got into the cadaver unit, I ended up having to do a lot of research and found out that, well, the dogs need a lot more than just those odors in order to detect human remains that are from everything from head to toe. So it's not as simple as putting the dog on a full cadaver. It doesn't work that way. There's a lot of different called volatile organic compounds, VOCs, that come off us when we pass away. And you have to get the dog in all those situations and try to get him exposed to as many of those VOCs as you can in order for him to become a good cadaver dog.
Wow. So, because not all the cadavers are going to have all those elements to it.
Exactly.
I see.
Exactly. Yeah. So a person that just passed away, maybe they wandered into the woods and they passed away, and a day later, a dog finds him. Okay. He's using his scent and his abilities to do that. But let's say a person passed away 40 years ago and is buried 8 feet below the surface. You need to have certain training for that as well. So you have to have dogs that have gone through specific training. And down in the United States, where I started taking Major, and then we were able to take our other cadaver dog at the time, we were able to get exposure to those situations, which made it invaluable, basically, for the work we did here in Canada.
So Major has the ability to not only find a more recent remains, but 25 years ago?
We had them on historical buries down in the United States on places such as, let's say, somebody had many farms and they've been burying their loved ones there since the 1800s. We were able to utilize those places for research and for our dogs to work on. Major had found the early 1800s burials. No headstones. The families know they were there. They know they're in a specific area, and the dogs would work on that and find it. And plus, we were able to use bones at the universities that we worked at down there that were carbon dated to 800 to 1200 years ago. So we were able to use those kind of things. So all those VOCs I was talking about earlier, they're all emitted in different ways.
That's really fascinating. Derek, you've been on a lot of cases with Major. Leaving Bruce MacArthur aside for now, are there other cases that stand out as you look back on your career?
There was a shootout in the middle of downtown, well, actually in the beach of Toronto on a Sunday afternoon. It was a cold day. There were several shots fired. There was some cars crashing into one another. And I was called down there along with my other partner, who was a handler as well, after the fact to look for property. I think that we had a person in custody, some people had gotten away. So I go down there almost an hour and a half afterwards. There was a large crime scene. Then I had one lady outside the crime scene saying, I saw just two people running down this alleyway. And of course, there was no crime scene tape over there. There was no officers guarding that area. So I took Major over there, and within several minutes, he was able to locate a balaclava that one of the suspects was wearing. And Major pulled himself under a bit of a fence, and he found a loaded handgun. It wasn't even in the crime scene area. So it just goes to show you that how valuable our dogs are. Other than just finding people, they'll find evidence such as guns, such as clothing that the suspects were wearing. And it's pretty good, especially when it's a good long time after the fact, right? We get a loaded handgun off the street just for that simple act of just listening to people.
Well, you know, you say it so easily, Derek, but I'm kind of just taken back by the abilities that you're describing. Let me just shift for a sec to your personal life with Major. I mean, typically you have a partner. At the end of the shift, you go your way, your partner goes the other way. But with Major, Major comes home with you every night. So once you get home, do you have a typical owner-dog relationship, or is it still different?
When we were working together, Major and I had it was basically strictly a working business. That's basically what we were. We were partners. We work all the time together, but you're right. We're together 24 hours a day. And so if I was to get up in the morning, a typical day to go to work, whatever shift I was working, I would get Major out of his kennel, get him into the truck and drive to work. He knew what was going on. Every time we were going into work, he was excited to get into the car, especially once we got into work, he was raring to go. So when we would go home, most of the time it would always be back home, feed him, and then into his kennel. Now his kennel's outside. It's insulated, has a heater in it. We also have a outside cage, 4x6, so he gets to stretch. And in the summertime, fans. In the wintertime, we have plastic sheets that cover over the cage area, so keep the wind out. So they're well looked after, and the dogs want to be outside anyway. So they're acclimatized at all times. So in the middle of winter, I wouldn't pull him out of my house, like 25 degrees in the house, drag him out and expect him to go run after someone at minus 40 wind chill. So basically, you're always keeping your dog in the climate that they're working in.
But he's not living a typical dog's life. You're not going to go to an off-leash park and let Major run around.
No, it can't work that way. I mean, when we sign up and we work at the canine unit, we have to follow basically a policy code. And one of them is you can't bring dogs to dog parks. For a lot of reasons, because Major at the time was not my dog. He was owned by the Toronto Police Board. So I can't just let him go and run around with other dogs. And now if he bites another dog or a person in that dog park, am I responsible? Sure, but so is the Toronto Police Service, right? So to be able to control the dogs at all times, and that's a big thing, obviously, both when you're working and when you're at home.
It's fair to say Major doesn't live the typical dog's life, but what about you? Is your family and social life different because you've got Major at home with you?
Yes. Lots of things we can't do. I can't just say, okay, we're going to go to a friend's place and we're going to stay the night and come back the next day. No, I have Major at home. Major's out in the kennel. He has to be looked after. Or if you always have to organize things, like I have a wedding coming up this weekend, for example. So I can leave Major in the house now. He's getting better. But when we were working, he was in the kennels. And if you leave him in there for, 8-10 hours, then don't we have to use the washer? He wants to get out of the kennel and do that. And Major does have a few medical problems as well. And one of them is irritable bowel syndrome. So I have to make sure I get him out. You're always thinking in your mind, if I go do something, I got to get back and let the dog out. So yeah, it takes a little bit of time away from what we would normally be doing as a family sometimes. Or my wife and I want to go do something. A lot of times he comes with us. So that's sometimes the easiest thing to do, just take him with us.
So can anybody else let Major out or take Major for a walk? Does it have to be you?
During work, when Major was the police dog, yes, it was just the handler.
Okay.
Is responsible for walking the dog. And again, it all has to do with control and it has to do with risk management in regards to if the dog got away, and bit somebody or bit another dog. So he's always in my control. When it's like any dog, when a dog sees a squirrel or a rabbit, what do? Right? They pull at it, they go after it. It's a lot of work on and off duty. You're dealing with the dog.
You mentioned chasing squirrels, and I'm trying to picture, let's say Major's chasing the culprit or trying to find someone who's lost in a ravine. Is he dialed in at that point? Can another dog or a squirrel or a coyote, can that get him off the task?
It can. Sometimes you do get a distraction. And a lot of times it has to do with maybe they're off the scent. And then, of course, if another animal runs by their path and boom, they want to go after the animal because they're not on that scent. That's why during training, our trainers will bring us to areas where they know there's a dog park nearby or people are walking their dogs, or there's a school nearby where lots of kids have walked the path, for example, and try to see if they get the dog off the scent that they were supposed to be following. So it takes time, and then eventually the dog knows when he gets to the end and finds the person or finds the article that we were training them to look for and gets his reward, which is a ball. Then they go, oh, okay. They're more excited now, right? They go, I'm going to do this more often because I'm getting that ball. I don't care about that squirrel that ran by or those kids that are over there. So it's a training thing that we deal with in order for that to happen and make it better. But I've seen Major totally go after squirrels when we're walking them. And then when we're on a track, it is, you can put 100 squirrels in front of him and he'll just go right by them.
Once he's got that scent.
Yeah, the focus is unbelievable because he wants to please me. He wants to get that reward at the end. Yes.
So let's talk about the most notorious case, I think, that you were involved with, serial killer Bruce MacArthur. Most listeners are familiar with the case, but maybe you can just give us an overview of where they were at with the case when you were asked to get involved.
Okay. We weren't part of me and the other cadaver handler as well. We weren't part of the investigative team at the time. They were working well before we got involved. And how we got involved is we started to work through some information that they were gathering to check properties. So we would take our cadaver dogs and go and check properties, walk in the backyard of somewhere or up a sort of field or something to see if we get any type of indication from our dogs. We were brought to Mallory Crescent at the time in January. So they brought our dogs in that night. And I remember it was a very cold January night and everything was frozen and we had both dogs there. So how we did it is that I went first into the backyard and was told by the investigators, you know, just can you search this backyard area? I would go first and the other handler would stay, remain in the truck and not watch me. Now we do that for a few different reasons. But one is for that we don't give ourselves any tells. And we don't give our dogs any tells. So I didn't know what the other handler was doing and she didn't know what I was doing. So when I took Major out and got him into that backyard, I had him on a long line. And basically I'm kind of doing like almost like a grid pattern. There's a fence to one side. There's a ravine going down on a couple of sides. A few things in the backyard and of course some of these planters. And as I was trying to get him to go along the grass area, kind of a grid, just to make sure we're walking up and down, make sure his nose is working like we're supposed to, just like the training I was telling you about earlier. He went over to one of the planters and kind of got up on his hind legs with it, because it was maybe about 2.5 feet tall, maybe 3 feet high, and then jumped down. You know, I kept giving the command to do what he was supposed to do. And as we got back to one of the planters, again, it's the same thing. He goes into this method of trying to tell me something sometimes. And a lot of times what he does is a sit. Okay. A sit is a reaction for a final response for Major in the cadaver order. So when he can't sit, a lot of times he'll go into a complete stand where his tail stops and he stares at me. And that's a lot of times do with the ground. Maybe he's in water, maybe he's on rocks where he can't sit perfectly. I think because of the odor that he was getting, it was a little higher up. I think he wanted to get up on this planter. So I pulled him away from there, got him to work the yard, continue to work the yard again, knowing that I'm going to make it back towards this planter. It was a couple that he was interested in. And lo and behold, as soon as we got within, you know, 4 or 5 feet of that planter again, because of the way the wind was blowing, he just went right up to it. And that second time we went up to it, he's telling me, okay, he's detecting the decomposition odor of human remains. That's what he's telling me. The investigators were in the back there at the time, and that's immediately what I told him. And I got him off that planter. He went to another planter and was doing basically a similar thing. I tried to finish my grid search, but I said to the investigators, okay, we're down here. I want to get him out and we'll get the other dog in and give him that break, because now he's going back to these planters. He didn't care about anything else. That's where the odor to him was coming from. Okay, so I had to get him away from there now, because now he's telling me. He goes, why are you doing something about it? Because he's telling me, where's my toy? I'm telling you, there's an odor here. So, and then I waited for the other handler to do exactly the same thing. And then both dogs were giving their handlers the indication of human remains from those planters. So then that's when the bells and whistles were going off in the investigators' minds. They're looking at us like, well, we're not talking ground here. I said, the planters. And it wasn't under the planters, it was in the planters. You could tell by the way the dogs were working. You could see the investigators carrying those planters around to the trucks at the front. So we came back 2 days later. My suggestion was to put them into the garage truck because the weather was going to get a little bit warmer. So that was a decision that they made, to put them into the garage. We came back a couple of days later. When I brought Major over to the garage, before they even opened the door, he was indicating at the bottom of the door. He put his nose down and sat there. it was indicating there was odor inside the garage. So as soon as they opened up the garage door, that was it, right? There was no question in my mind. The first night there was odor coming from there, but obviously that was it for telling me that there's a decomp of human remains there.
But even on that first time, Derek,
yes,
you know Major really well. Were you 100% confident we've got something here?
In my mind, I always do the 99% thing. Is there a chance that somebody cut themselves working in that planter and they bled there and, you know, when you're chopping flowers or something, that you got to think of that. But the reaction to the dogs, both dogs doing similar things at the same time and to what the investigators are telling us, right? So now we had more than just the dogs searching randomly. This was an area that they needed to check because they had information through their investigation. So that kind of puts in the back of my mind thinking, okay, this is something. So I went home that night, and the next day we were searching another property up north, and we were still talking about the night before, the other handler and I, right? So we were kind of to the point where it was, okay, we know we're going back the next day. And when they took those planters and took them up to the coroner's office, it was 2 days. I was on my days off, and I couldn't think of anything else. I just thought, can't wait for them see what, if someone's going to call me. And then eventually I got a call from one of our forensic officers who was up there at the coroner's office and told me that, yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I heard the head of the investigation unit talk to the media after the findings, and he specifically talked about your work and Major. You must have felt, I don't know, just real proud that not just that you found the evidence, but there were so many families that wanted closure on this that you were part of giving them that.
Yes, it's always something that says, as anybody, but as a police officer who's been training a dog to find human remains and doing it for so long, and then when it works, like all the work I put into it and all the expenses and traveling that I did and the other dogs did to get to the level that they were able to do this, yeah, it's very rewarding. And, you know, when I watch it on TV and I see some of the families, they're still obviously upset, but at the same time, you could tell a relief. Okay. They have their loved ones back and they're able to, you know, have a decent burial for them. It is very rewarding because we did what we were trained to do. My dog and myself were a team and we did what we needed to do. We did what I was trained to do, my dog was trained to do. And I was pretty proud of that.
I guess it was also a relief. I mean, the police took a lot of heat from the gay community and others for not getting quicker to this. So I would guess this at least made it feel good that this part they really got right.
They did. I mean, it was a very complex case over the years. Obviously, it's not as simple as someone watching an hour's TV show and then everything gets dealt with and towards the end of the hour, right? It doesn't work that way. And some of the investigators, they were putting hours and hours and from days off, they were missing things with their families because they were working this case so hard and it takes a toll on everybody. So for that to be dealt with and then for Bruce MacArthur to go to court and plead guilty instead of a long drawn out trial with the families and officers, that made things a bit easier. I'm assuming for the families and of course for the officers as well. And then you put closure to that case and you move on, right? You go on to the next case, but that's the way, that's the way it works. And of course there was a lot of backlash, but the amount of work and the expertise that gone into bringing our dogs to those properties that we needed to get to was from great investigative skills.
Well, you even brought Major to court, right? On the day that pleaded guilty. I mean, what was that
about? The day he was pleading guilty, I went to court because one thing, I was working. So that means my dog's with me. I was in the courtroom when Bruce MacArthur pled guilty. And I was at the court afterwards. There was a lot of media attention to the officers, which was great. But then I had a request by a few of the media if I could bring Major over, you know, for a little bit of a photo session. I had no problem doing that because I have no problem showing the people that the investigators, everybody did a great job. And of course, the dogs, they made things move a little quicker because we found the areas that Bruce MacArthur was using quicker than if it would have been done by human eyes and human touch, right? I was proud to bring my dog out and show, this is Major here. He has no idea what's going on, but. Here's Major again, because obviously he was on the news quite a bit and so was our other dog, Blue. And it was a good feeling to be there and see it happen. So that case was done, to me, was done extremely well.
That's a very insightful story, Derek. I really appreciate you telling it so lucidly. I'm not sure if that case then seemed like for you the perfect way to end your career, but I mean, you and the Major retired not long after that.
We retired about 2 or 3 years later after the MacArthur case. And I was getting to a point where when I can retire, you know, you start looking at it's a nice idea knowing you can retire. But at the same time, Major was almost 9 years old. And right now he's almost 10. So, and he has medical problems and has a lot of muscle strains. He has, of course, the Urbel syndrome. He has a heart murmur. And a lot of times heart murmurs don't go really well for dogs, particularly dogs that are working in the police world because they can have heart attacks. And my dog protects me at all times. So during calls, it becomes a bit of a liability. Can Major look after me if something happens? Is he going to protect me from somebody or that kind of thing? Or is he going to have a heart attack? So I looked at that. I looked at, well, can I give him a little bit of a life? And I was looking at retirement too and have him kind of relax so he can work through some of his medical problems without worrying about the stress of the job. And that was kind of one of my reasons to retire.
Part of the reason Major has these problems is because of the physical feats and his daily routine.
Yes, it's a big factor. And a lot of it has to do with the amount of training that we do and the calls that we do. I was trying to remember, but I know I've thrown him physically over 18 fences. So you got to think, so if this fence is 4 feet high or 8 feet high, you're throwing him over and he's got to land right on the other side. So if he's around 74, 75 pounds, then he's landing all that weight onto his front legs and chest area. So those kind of things take an extreme amount of toll on them. You know, they are working. The dog starts to inhale a lot. He's starting to breathe in. They use their nose, as you know. So it's like you and I having this conversation right now, jogging. Okay. So you and I have been jogging for the last 20 minutes and we're talking back and forth. So what happens with their voice? We can feel it, right? So when the dogs are working, they're constantly doing that. They're breathing in all that air, trying to find that odor. So even though you see a police dog and he's kind of moving around, he's not really running, but he's smelling the ground, he's utilizing a lot of energy. And that takes a lot of toll over years as well. I've seen him being punched, kicked by suspects that he's taken down. Those kind of things over time again, right? The more it happens, the more the dog could end up with some injuries that go into his retirement years as well.
So when you retired, Derek, you got a full pension.
Correct.
And I'll just cut to the chase. Major gets nothing. Isn't that the case?
That's correct. As soon as the dog retires, I have to sign a form that I'm responsible for him and have to pay the city $1, basically. Toronto Police Service is not responsible for Major. As soon as I drive him off that property on his last day, and that comes down to everything. So all the vet bills, all the pills that he's on, all those things are all my responsibility, as well as other handlers. Whatever handler takes home the dog and whatever medical problems they have. The Toronto Police Service, and I say this recently, but I mean, you know, 1989, 32 years ago is when the unit started. And it's only been like 4 or 5 years ago where an officer that we had was able to fight it and get food for life, basically, for a retired dog. So we do get food for retired dogs from the Toronto Police. But there's so many other things. So some dogs, such as Major, is on so many different pills. He's on a certain type of food. And he's also has some teeth problems. He has, obviously, the heart murmur. So those things add up extremely fast when you start going to the vet after retirement. Basically, one of the reasons why we're speaking today is that my sister-in-law has sent me a note because she's a retired RCMP member about Ned's Wish. I Googled Ned's Wish and they take retired police dogs and you can register them. So I did it that night. So I thought, okay, put all this stuff in about Major. It was almost like I was trying to put him into a Montessori school. I thought I better give him all kinds of, you know, make sure I put all kinds of nice stuff about what he did and that kind of stuff. Then I started getting emails from Ned's Wish, the president and secretary and those kind of things. And they're all excited. Oh, the first Toronto dog and thank you. And notes is great. And I had no idea about this. So it kind of opened my eyes a little bit to, there are people out there that care. And I'm not saying people don't care about police dogs in retirement, but this foundation is absolutely incredible because they do care. They actually did something about it, you know. So that's how I kind of got involved and try to promote the Ned's Wish Foundation in order to get people out there to know that, yes, police dogs do not get help in retirement. And this is the only help we can get is through Ned's Wish.
Derek, you could have walked away from Major, but is there an expectation that you always take your dog with you when you retire?
There is not. There was several handlers who worked there who do not take their police dogs for a lot of reasons. They don't have the room. They took on another dog. They already have a family pet, for example. So it's a big responsibility. But from most of us out there and some of the other handlers, police handlers that are listening now, they'll know, you know, it's the bond that you have. It's tough.
Yeah.
It's hard to get rid of a dog that you have such a strong bond with who's out protecting yourself and that you come home with every day and then go to work every day. It's something that I could not think to myself to get Major to another person.
Who would you say has adjusted better to retirement?
For the most part, it would have been me for sure, because I mean, my first day off in retirement was great. Yeah, of course, I missed work. I missed the excitement of the dog work, but it was easier for me because I can keep busy with other activities. where his activity is work, right? And his activity is looking for human remains or finding people hiding. And when you stop that cold turkey, I could tell by his mannerisms, he wasn't having a good first 2 or 3 months. He was having a rough go. But the last couple months, he's really come around. He's more calm in the house. He's not as rambunctious. He's not scratching the floors as much. He's not running up to the doors. And so, you know, getting them into a house and becoming a house dog was one thing, but to get them to settle down and to just relax was another thing.
All right, Derek, I should wrap up. Honestly, I could talk to you all day. This is really interesting stuff for us. You've seen some gruesome things in your career. Mm-hmm. I don't know how that affects your viewpoint of the city of Toronto, where you did a lot of work, but do you still have a fondness for Toronto? And what is it stands out that you think is good about Toronto?
What I think what's good about Toronto is the people that I've met over the years. I mean, I worked in so many different units that I was able to go to all parts of the city. I mean, you're at festivals, you bring my dog to community events. So, you know, you see the kids' expressions on their faces. I get to meet a lot of people within the city who I thought were great. People who, not just victims of crime, but people who were witnesses or people who just came up to me and to offer a bottle of water at a call or something that means something, right? So I do miss that part of it. But the one thing I don't miss at all about Toronto, and that's probably what most people say, is traffic. That's the best thing about being retired. I'm not driving the traffic anymore.
That's great. Listen, I got to let you go. Pardon the pun, but you have some major work to do today, I'm sure. So,
Yes, Tom, thank you.
But listen, congratulations. A fabulous career. You have stories to last a lifetime, Derek. So anyway, I wish you, Major, your family, everyone, lots of good times and good health in these retirement years. I really appreciate you doing this.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for having us. And I hope the interview with Ned Wish goes well and people help support them.
As Sergeant Gaudette pointed out, he and other police dog owners have benefited greatly from Ned's Wish Foundation. So on his suggestion, we made a call to the CEO of Ned's Wish, Stacy Talbot. Hello, Stacy, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
Well, I thought maybe we could start, Stacy, with, I mean, the fact is you're not only the CEO of Ned's Wish Foundation, but you're also the founder. So tell us a bit about who Ned was and why you decided to set up a foundation in his name.
Well, Ned was my second retired police dog. I'm an old recently retired RCMP member after 38 years and had the pleasure of course, working with dog section throughout my whole career. Ned, in particular, when I got him, I had a lot of interesting health issues pop up, shall we say. And what I realized back then was that veterinary medicine had really come a long way, but the costs had actually skyrocketed. So to take on a retired police dog has a lot of costs associated to them based on the work they performed. It was a bit of a monumental lift, if you will, to pay all the vet bills that came with them. I realized after doing some research, there really wasn't any support for these dogs when they retire from their law enforcement agencies. So that was where Ned's Wish was founded. Myself and some amazing people, volunteers, friends and family kind of got together and said, let's see if we can't help these heroes out and do something about it.
We had a great chat with Sergeant Gaudette, and he mentioned that dogs like his dog, Major, they just have way more serious injuries than most dogs do. And I'm guessing even in the short time the foundation's been around, you've probably seen some pretty difficult and expensive situations.
Yeah, it really kind of runs the gamut. One of the first things I encountered with Ned was tracking is, and I'm not a handler, but I watched enough to know that this is a huge physical exercise for these dogs. So tracking and different things and jumping, these dogs, whether it's tendons and ligaments, it's back, it's teeth, you know, they're like a pro athlete that's had a lot of hard miles. And when they retire now, with veterinary medicine being the way it is, just diagnostics alone can run you into thousands of dollars.
Okay, so let's break the foundation down a bit. How do you raise money?
We're 100% volunteers. We have a board of directors. We're an administrative board. So that's 99% of all the people that are doing the work are the board of directors and a few key volunteers that we have. What we do is dog gets registered. We vet the dog to make sure it's a legitimate police dog or military dog. Of course, coming out of the pandemic, we've been pretty much an online presence. So we've been trying to grow our following so that when we have a dog in need, we can do a fundraiser for them to pay their medical bills. We have silent auctions that we've had online. So now coming out of the pandemic, it's been great because we had our first annual golf tournament. Last year, we lost two dogs from the RCMP alone in the line of duty. So we do an annual Heroes Run where we'll be featuring a dog that was killed in the line of duty. And that's a fun run that's coming up September 25th. And the great thing about it is you can do it with your dog and you can do it virtual. So you can do it anywhere in the country. And then the other thing is that we have got such an amazing community that people just go out and do their own things. You're kind of unlimited as to what you can do.
You've only been around a couple of years. How many dogs have you been able to help?
We've had just over 120 dogs registered. Now, we're in it for the quality. We don't have them a long time.
Sure.
But at any given time, we're probably running 60 to 70 dogs on the books, maybe even a little more that we're trying to support. What we do is if they need it, it's all about the medical and the veterinary expenses for them. So they actually go in and if the vet deems that it needs a procedure, then they come to us and we will look at the vet bill and always based on funding, obviously. And
sure.
And how much money we have in the kitty. If we don't have enough money in the kitty, then that's when we go out and do our emergency fundraisers and try to make sure we can cover those expenses.
You know, I think it would be kind of easy for you, Stacy, to say these police forces should be taking care of these dogs themselves and you could be fighting for that. But you seem to be sympathetic to the fact that there's limited budgets with police forces. So you're not really on their case that much.
We have to work together. And for us, it's really about the dog. Having been in law enforcement for 38 years, there is no magic money tree. You and I both know that when you start raising taxpayers' taxes, there's only so much money in the pot and they've got to keep their working dogs working. I can tell you that even in the short time that Ned's Wish has been operating, the educational piece, we have seen Peel Regional now is starting to come on board and they're giving their dogs annual vaccinations and food. I don't believe any agency would like to not support it, but it really comes down to dollars and cents. And what we're trying to do with Ned's Wish is our longer term goal would be to, you know, approach maybe Veterans Affairs or some other form of government that would recognize them as a retiree or a veteran and that they would be able to also support. So it's a work in progress, but right now we just want to take care of the dogs.
I'm guessing that when you have these fundraising events, people must really warm up to what you're doing.
You know, it's amazing, Tom, when you're out talking to the public. And I've got my old retired guy there, or right now we're at the RCMP demo days and you're seeing some of the young ones coming up to be new heroes. It really is. It's people are getting a better understanding and they're so giving because they know these dogs are putting their life on the line. I mean, they go to work every day just for, you know, a Kong ball and some kibble and they're more than happy to do it, right? So it really is gratifying. And the other piece that I didn't realize until we got into it, dog handlers are a little bit of a special breed of policemen because they get everything from the missing kid to the break and enter to the small evidence on a homicide to our highest risk calls with a barricade. And they're kind of at the sharp, pointy end of the stick. You have no idea what it means for somebody to say, oh my God, my partner that saved my life, how many times over is sick? Mm-hmm. And there's a $15,000 vet bill. How am I going to deal with this? And so when we can step up and say, hey, you know what? You worry about getting your dog better and we'll take care of that retired hero.
I can tell you, say, I could verify what you're saying because when we contacted Sergeant Cadet, he was so thankful for your financial aid and gung-ho about your operations. Honestly, he said to me, yeah, I'd love to do the podcast, but hey, you have to get Stacy on because she is doing fantastic work.
Well, that is so kind of Derek. And you know what, Tom, I can't thank you enough.
Well, Tracy, you are a great spokesperson for NEDS, and I think our listeners will be touched by what you've said today, and I hope they will consider making a donation. Can you give us the name of your site?
Absolutely. We are www.nedswish.com. And we have a Facebook underscore Ned's Wish, and we have an Instagram account. Please look us up. Please follow us. Any little bit of support and any of your community that would love to follow us, we would be eternally grateful for.
Stacy, really enjoyed chatting with you today. Thanks so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Tom. It's been awesome.
If you enjoyed this podcast, I think you might also enjoy an interview we did in season 1, episode 2, with two police officers who are providing fascinating crime scene tours in Toronto. You can find that episode on our site, hiddengemstoronto.net. And next month, I hope you'll join us to hear our interview with the owner of Skull Store in Prehistoria, a very unorthodox museum in Toronto that bills itself as the largest oddity shop in Canada. Odd, of course, for only you listeners who consider buying a human skull or a fossilized Tyrannosaurus tooth fragment is something out of the norm. His museum is unlike any museum I have ever visited, and he happens to be a great storyteller to boot. I hope you'll join us on October 1st. The Hidden Gems podcast is edited by Sharon Scanlon. Thanks for listening.